It's a brand new best podcast in baseball with two writers from the Post-Dispatch. We're going to talk about the three things we're each looking for as the Cardinals head into a three-series homestand. Their last three-series homestand of the season, and what a doozy. Bookending a visit by the Colorado Rockies is a visit from the Chicago Cubs as they try to claw their way back in the division, and then the New York Yankees as they try to claw their way back to relevance in the AL East. Sports columnist Jeff Gordon joins me. Cues of the music. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closet by Design of St. Louis. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, joined this week again by our instant offense at STLtoday.com. He's going to be talking fast because he not only has to do a chat and a video and probably another podcast today, but this one we've drawn in Jeff Gordon for some post-trade deadline, post-West Coast talk. And a lot of it will be focused on the homestand ahead, but let's get right to the news, Gordo, the news of the day. Yadier Molina back in number four, back with the birds on the bat, and is going to be making a cameo in the dugout. What do you make of the return, this long-awaited, long-discussed, and Oliver Marmol initiated return for Molina, even briefly, to the dugout?
Yeah, Yadi's such an interesting case. You know, he's got ambitions, and certainly his managing of an international play has been intriguing. Has the aptitude to do this, but he's been committed to family, and understandably so after decades in organized baseball and the long grind of being a catcher at the big league level and just a tremendous career. Who could blame him for wanting to spend time with his family, particularly with a young ball player with aspirations of his own? So, you know, I was disappointed that Yadi didn't get more involved right away as a special assistant when he had that opportunity to sort of cherry pick some assignments in the organization. But I get it. The question I have, Derek, is, you know, at what point in his life will he want to make the commitment that it would take to be a coach, a bench coach, a manager? Certainly has those aspirations to be a manager at the big league level and the aptitude. But, man, the time commitment. Ask Ali about that.
Yeah, yeah. When all the peripheral stuff, too, like dealing with the media. I mean, that's part of it. It's not just, you know, it's an interesting thing because, like, you see the players who want to be manager because of the vision of how much they're in control, right? But once you get a sense of the commitment, not just to the game, but like just the hours that it takes to satisfy the media requirements, you know, you think about like the radio shows that Yadier Molina would have to do, the interviews pregame and postgame, the things like that. I mean, he watched other managers do this. He's seen them handled well and handled poorly as a player. You know, Marmol definitely makes himself available. He does the KMOX and appears on radio, does obviously a lot before games. Would all of that intrigue or even be of interest to Molina? Or you see former players in that bench coach role where they get to kind of drill down on organizing the logistics of the staff and be involved in the discussion about managing the game without the requirements of the media. Bench coach tends to be a launch pad, especially here with the Cardinals over the last 10, 12 years for future managers. So does that fit? You know, the moment Daniel Descalso gets a chance to go elsewhere and takes John Jay with him, is it Molina's time then? Because his oldest son will be at UT Arlington. That's where he's committed to play. You know, he's had a really strong year there in Texas where Yadi's relocated. So will the timing be right there? I don't know. And, you know, but they want to give him a chance to explore it and see what it's like. But they also really just want his presence around. That's something that has been missing. It is something that obviously Mike Schilt brought up. The lack of Cardinal greats around the team has really been something that Oliver Marmol has tried to champion and bring them back and have them invited in. You know, you have Isringhausen and Ludwig on staff, but we've also wanted to have Pujols around. He's an employee of the Angels, so that's tricky. But Molina's been the one that they invite, and this is the time he said yes.
I got a question back for Derek Gould, though. Chaim Bloom coming in from the outside to run the organization. He hired people from the outside to help fortify the whole baseball development side, player development side, minor leagues. A new era coming to St. Louis. Will the Chaim Bloom era be less nostalgic when it comes to the Cardinals than the John Mozeliak era?
I don't know. That's a great question. It's been a real pivot of the organization, Jeff, since the pandemic. You think they about that time where they were scaling back, right? Everybody was for spending. There were furloughs throughout our industry and layoffs. Baseball also, they had layoffs and they had downsizing of staffs. The Cardinals elected to not have their collection of former players, those special advisors. And so that is how Chris Carpenter ended up with the Angels. They did bring Isringhausen back. They did bring Ludwig back. But guys like Braden Looper, he now works for an agent. So, they did lose some of that group. And then, of course, there are the fact that, several of the people of the all-time greats who are around a lot passed away in the last few years. And so we've really seen less of that nostalgia in the last few years with Mozeliak in charge. Again, it was a flashpoint with Mike Schilt during his departure from the team was, where were the Cardinal greats? Where were why hadn't they come back? And it has been a focus of Marmol. So yes, what will Chaim Bloom? He doesn't talk publicly much, but from talking to people who do talk to him, well, he doesn't talk publicly at all in his current role. But we'll know more about him here in the coming weeks, and we'll hear more from him there towards the end of this season. But from those who talk to him, he wants to kind of keep that tradition going. Rob Serfolio, the assistant general manager in charge of player development and player performance, talks about that. He has spent some time along with Chaim Bloom, what were the kind of the core principles of the quote unquote Cardinal way? What are some of the things that they did really well with player development? What were some of the things that George Kissel set forth that still apply and can still be used? They have looked into all that. And I don't think there is going to be a complete dismissal of nostalgia. I think there's going to be a real attempt to augment a modern approach with with some of that history, with some of that tradition. So it'll be kind of like a cyborg Cardinal way, right? It'll have all the new tech, but still have some of the heart of the Cardinal way.
And not to be too cynical here, Derek, but this franchise has got a lot of work to do.
Yes.
Engaged. And the Cardinals have, over the years, during the DeWitt era, marketed the heck out of their former greats, and rightfully so, because they have former greats where other franchises don't.
Right.
So much. So they've been really smart about that, and that's going to have to be a big part of their business plan going forward because, frankly, the product on the field's been okay this year, but not as certainly compelling as the history of the franchise, which, again, this franchise has a history that few can match. A couple franchises can make such a claim, and that's it.
Yeah, you're right. And that allows us to kind of launch into the question that I wanted to use as the framework for this conversation. And that's, what are three things that we look for in this three series homestand? And I'll get right to it. I mean, look, that last check, the Cardinals have over the past 4 or 5 years dropped from second in average attendance to now 17th at last check. First thing I'm looking for, it's not the most important thing, but it is the first thing to discuss, that I'm looking for in this series, Jeff, is attendance. They have Cubs in town for a weekend series, then the Rockies, and then the Yankees in town for a weekend series. Cubs weekend, Yankees weekend, school about to start. The temperatures should be cooler. It'll still be hot, but still be cooler. Cardinals hovering around 500. They sold at the deadline, so they've already sent a message there as to where they expect to be in the standing. But they are capable of playing an entertaining brand of baseball. What do you think, Jeff? I mean, if they get good, strong crowds, then it seems like people will be reacting to the opponent, and there might be a whole lot of Cubs fans. There might be a whole lot of Yankee fans in town purchasing those tickets. But how big a deal will it be if the crowds are soft for this homestand?
Yeah, I think those two opponents will make it less terrible for sure. Attendance has been shocking. Now, I will say not as shocking as a Memphis Redbirds attendance. Watching the game last night on FanDuel, there might have been 14 people at that game in Memphis. That was a little rough. But it's shocking to see where the attendance has gone, Derek. I mean, it wasn't that long ago, maybe 2 years, where a weeknight game would draw over 30,000 people. Now it's closer to 20. And, you know, we've talked about this topic. So I think they'll be okay on this homestand because two of the opponents will draw. But, man, this is – I think even as much as I anticipated fall off, I'm stunned at just how dramatic the fall off is, really. And I know fans have been saying it's coming, and we do live chats, and they warned us it was coming. Mm-hmm. I'm never going back. They've been saying that for years, but they came back. This time they didn't. So, yeah, I think it's just a huge thing to watch this weekend. And when you're having a discount and promote game tickets for, like, a Yankee series, mm-hmm. wow, that's tough.
What do you make of the fact, Jeff, that when they were playing well and well above 500 and, you know, flirting with the notion of contention, that the crowds were inconsistent? There's a really good crowd, really, like, all right, maybe this is an indicator crowd with the Diamondbacks in town. Certainly they did well there, but you know, what do you make of the fact that I don't really see fans responding to the team as the event they want to see?
Yeah. And we've talked about this team, and I think Ollie's doing his best to create an appealing style. I think they're trying to play aggressively. We've talked about having a style of play and identity. I think Ollie's been pushing for that. And maybe not as aggressively as, say, the Brewers are just a magical team this year with their ability to win games and play that way, just pushing it on every single opportunity. But this is a pretty good team, and there are some marketable young players on this team, some people with some real upside and good performance levels. So this is – I am surprised because this is not a terrible team, and there is a future here. And a lot of these guys have some personality. You know, Alec Burleson has personality. Mm-hmm. Mason Wynn is a kind of a command on the field. Victor Scott with his explosive speed can cause some havoc both in the field and on the bases. You know, there's some things to look at. I think Herrera is an exciting hitter. There's a lot to like about what's happening with the group, the position players anyways. And so to see this reaction from the public, to me, you know, we go back and talk about messaging at the start and just not being able to overcome it. You know, the offseason, the messaging. And even though things got going pretty good this season, the weather's been atrocious. If it's not raining, it's a million degrees or both. And a stadium that offers very little relief from the climate that we have here in St. Louis in the summer. Not unlike Bush 2, but which was tremendously good at holding heat. But, man, it's just – there's just been enough reasons for people to stay away. I mean, there's just – you know, the negative echo chamber just swallowed this team up. And no matter how much these guys try, at least this year, they can't get out of it.
I don't know. And then it makes you wonder what we'll get out of it. Jeff, what's something that you're looking for in this homestand?
Well, looking at individual things, you know, one thing to point right away is Jordan Walker. He's not the Jordan Walker the Cardinals were hoping to see a few years ago, but he is a competitive Jordan Walker at the plate. Made some adjustments and has been at least putting the ball in the middle of the field, getting on base more often, making better swing decisions, actually forcing teams to come inside more on him, having closed up his stance a bit and done a better job covering pitches away. So, I mean, just want to watch and see where is Jordan Walker. I think his ceiling is lower, but can he reach that lower ceiling and be a decent big leaguer?
What does that look like for him? I'm intrigued by how you describe that. The ceiling is lower. What does that mean? Does that mean that he's less of a power factor, but still a contributing hitter as far as not making outs? Or what do you see for him?
Yeah, I mean, right now, one of his better assets is his speed. You know, he can beat out hits because he has a lot of balls on the ground, and he can steal a few bases, and he can cover a lot of ground in the outfield when he gets a good read. So that – his absence of power is concerning. Now, if he becomes a doubles hitter who can swipe 20 bases and hit, you know, 50 doubles and push his OPS at least closer to 800, be more selective at the plate, then he's a regular big leaguer. But I think earlier this season, Derek, we had to wonder, is he going to be a regular big leaguer or not? I mean, he was not very competitive until he got shut down with the with the illness and the recovery, and then the minor league retooling.
Yeah, it's an interesting, it's a fascinating career arc already, and I don't really know like where they see him fitting in. You know, I mean, he's not a platoon player. He has so much upside because of his size and because of his swing and because, or, I mean, the life in his swing, that they want to get more power from it. But that has just really, as they've tried to do that, that's just complicated it and made him less productive. So it's, that's really interesting. And yeah, and coming back home, you know, to Busch Stadium, you know, who knows? I'm always intrigued by like the pressure that isn't apparent on guys. And is that at home or at Busch Stadium? How aware are players when they're not reaching what the team set as their potential? And where does that manifest? Does it manifest at home? I think there's a real interesting conversation to be had there with the pressure that Jordan has put on himself because of the perception of his potential and where that has taken him.
Yeah, one thing we've talked about before, Derek, what I like to see from Jordan Walker is just that I like to see him smiling.
Yeah.
I can see him smiling more, enjoying the game like he did when he broke in. And, you know, he and Wynn were like enjoying the game, and Wynn just kept going with his career, and Jordan Walker's had all sorts of things get in his way in terms of his slumping and, you know, just his attempted reconstruction and then going back to the basics and all the things he's gone through. I just want to see him smiling, having fun, enjoying the game, putting the work in, which he does, and getting some results and just being a good player. And if it becomes more than that someday, as you often point out, I mean, big guys can take time.
Big guys can take time.
Swings, you know, long levers, as they say in hockey. It's a whole thing. But I just want to see him smiling and being productive again and staying in the lineup enough to become a good ball player.
One thing I'm looking for in this homestand is how the bullpen continues to sort out. It's a curious bullpen, to say the least. The Cardinals made a waiver claim of Jorge Alcala, the guy who was with the Twins and Red Sox already this season, throws hard, has a really snappy breaking ball, but walks too many people. So there'll have to be an adjustment there. They'll see if the Cardinals can be the one that taps into it. Swing and miss potential, but doesn't do a whole lot of good if there's a whole lot of runners on base via walk. So, and that's a tough spot to be in, you know, for a team to call on a reliever like that in late innings. And let's be honest, the late innings are wide open for the Cardinals. Not only do they subtract via the trade deadline Ryan Helsley and Steven Matz and Phil Maton, the former who was their closer, the latter who was their setup guy, but they, you know, now are going with a bunch of young guys in either new roles or undefined roles. And it's left them with one lefty, the one reliever that they'd really like to call on as the closer because of his experience in the role going back to 2023 as Jojo Romero, but they can't because he's the only lefty with John King on the injured list. It's a very curious roster when it comes to the relief options for Marmol and his staff. And yet it was a huge part of them winning the series at Dodger Stadium, how they navigated that. A huge part of that win specifically Wednesday when Shohei Ohtani was just brilliant for four innings with eight strikeouts and also a home run to give the Dodgers the lead. But the Cardinals won that game in large part because of their bullpen. Jeff, what did you see from the opportunity given Riley O'Brien? What do you see from the potential of Kyle Leahy? And where does young players like Gordon Graceffo and Matt Swanson and Rodri Munoz figure into all this?
Yeah, it's interesting. Of course, O'Brien gets your attention. You know, been around the block, been through injury, still has a very, very live arm. You know, and I think that you look at his potential late inning guy, the toolkit's there if he can stay healthy. Got nasty stuff. The league's going to adapt to him as they see more of him. But you certainly like the stuff there. Swanson's an interesting guy. You know, he's a guy that's had success all the way through the minors and has been productive as a late inning guy. And he certainly looks the part and has a pitch arsenal. He just has to be so much sharper at this level than, you know, in the minors when he racked up those opportunities. But the fact he did so much of it in the minors from his mindset, that part is attractive. And again, he just looks the part. Graceffo obviously looks the part. If he can keep his velocity up, and maybe that's by in the bullpen, he can do that. Again, he's at least because of the arm element, you know, the potential power. If he can, again, sharpness, he's going to have some bad outings. We've seen that. But, you know, they do have some potential with those guys. And opportunity, right? We'll see how they handle it mentally. It's just interesting to listen to guys, some of the comments you see out of guys is learning from other guys who have departed, like a Phil Maton's mental approach to pitching was so good. Well, now he's gone. Can they apply the learnings from sitting next to Phil all season,
right,
and do a better job in the mound?
I wrote a little bit about that in the Right Fielder, the newsletter that comes out every Friday to subscribers, stltoday.com. Plug. But yeah, I was really interested in the fact that, you know, you all week in San Diego and LA, as you talk to these young relievers and it sorted through kind of in real time what they were going to do, almost every single one of them brought up something they learned from or something they did from Phil Maton. Jojo Romero brought up Phil Maton multiple times with how he would challenge him in the bullpen and say, why do you throw this? Why do you throw this as they're watching another pitcher? And then Phil would either agree or come back and go, okay, no, I disagree. Let's talk through this. And I talked to Kyle Leahy on Wednesday there at Dodger Stadium. And I asked him, like, what's an example, specific example of what you do now that you didn't before knowing Phil Maton? He gave me some examples of what he looks for in video and being stubborn about his stuff and knowing the difference between, like you can cue up a bunch of curveballs and say, all right, this hitter doesn't handle curveballs well, or a better example is this guy does handle curveballs well, and he would watch Phil go, yeah, but does he handle my curveball? Let's try to figure that out. He would really dig into the granular details. And for a guy like Kyle who has multiple pitches, six different pitches, that's a real way to help him prep for those games, is to go, okay, yeah, but how does the guy do against a sinker like I have? How does he do against a slider like I have? That gives him a whole lot more information, a whole lot more pitches that he can go to. So, yeah, I mean, I wrote in the newsletter, not to quote myself, but like there's echoes of Phil Maton in the bullpen still. And I think his presence has changed some of the careers of these guys because of how he showed them how to prepare.
I love how Kyle Leahy has the Phil Maton mound presence of just could not be more calm and in blank face. Total opposite, by the way. I don't think he'll be a reliever unless all else fails, but Liam Doyle, opposite approach on the mound. Opposite.
Yeah. No, Kyle Leahy comes from a, you know, longtime coach family. He's you know, from that great Boulder Valley school system that produced such wonderful folks as you know, John Mozeliak and myself, you know, they're out there in Colorado. So, you know, he has that temperament, right? You see the similarities right away. But no, his dad and his granddad were coaches there. They coached at the high schools there, including the high school I went to. His granddad coached there for a little bit, basketball. But you know, Kyle Leahy has really emerged this season, and look for him to be a starter at least at the beginning of spring training next year. That's something that they're really going to look at, is how he does in that role. Jeff, what's the next thing you're looking for in this?
It's another topic with Nolan Arenado back in Jupiter, trying to just rebuild the body, rebuild the swing, see if there's more in the tank by the end of the season. Obviously, he's been cleared from the Nolan Gorman runway, so Nolan's going to get some work, finally some consistent work, regular work at third base. And can he play third base? I mean, we know who he is offensively, and talking to Lynn Worthy about this on Inside Pitch, we'll do a plug there. Lynn mentioned, you know, the Max Muncy comp, and, you know, if Nolan could be Max Muncy, he could make some money because Max Muncy's made some money. It's to be determined, though, among other things, can he hold up over there?
Yeah,
it's been a very sporadic bit of fielding work for him at that position after playing that position for so long. So can he get more comfortable there? And does the offense continue to translate to some degree, maybe more as a platoon type guy and more one-dimensional, but still, is there enough there?
Yeah, he struggled with his throws there. You know, he put Wilson Contreras in some compromising spots there with his arm, and Wilson at one point in time had to like shy away from even making a go at the catch just because he saw the runner in his periphery. I think that, you know, and Gorman, to his credit, spoke about that and said that, you know, just the timing of it and the, you know, if you throw it and the ball cuts or sails, it can make it really difficult on the first baseman. And he was experiencing some of that, that comes with feel, you know, I mean, you can't, you can take all the reps and work on it, work on it, work on it. And then all of a sudden you get in the game and the adrenaline is there and the game speed is there and it's Ellie Dela Cruz going down the line and you just can't create. You can try to create everything about that, but you can't. And you need the experience to do that. I wonder how much he has to hit to be a third baseman in this league versus how much he has to hit to be a second baseman in this league versus how much he has to hit to be a DH in this league. Increasingly, you look at the Cardinals roster, they sure do have a lot of DHs. They sure do have a handful of second basemen, but you start putting them at other positions or start asking them to move out of a comfort position, and either their performance at those positions or their profile at their positions just don't fit. I think the closest they've come, boy, as far as like new positions go, I think the closest they've come is probably Yvonne Herrera in left field, at least how he's taken to it. And certainly what his offensive profile is, you know, fits better in left field than initially we would have thought maybe a year ago, where he was a really high above average catcher. Well, he might be a above average left fielder too when you talk about offensive production.
Yeah, he's a good athlete too, right? I mean, and without subjecting him to any more catching and hopefully keep him away from some of those leg issues that he's already dealt with this year, running the bases and such. He's young enough where if you just say, okay, that's what you're going to do, and maybe mm-hmm. once in a blue moon you'll catch if we run, you know, get into a situation where you need a third catcher through some subbing issues. But otherwise, just become a hitter and use your athleticism. He's a good athlete, and he's still young enough where he hasn't taken the beating back there. I mean, I think that I just watching Pedro Pais catch this year. I mean, I think he's lost about 2 years of career playing time just on the beating he's taken back there. And, Herrera's a fascinating case. Gorman, yeah, where do you put him? I think if you were to profile him, my expectation is they hope he hits well enough to trade him, because I just think there's so many other ways they can go with their infield. Whether, you know, Weatherholt could play third, you want to keep Brendan Donovan, you want to trade Donovan, then you put Weatherholt there. But can Gorman really play third base? It's fascinating. And the time will, this time that he has to prove or disprove his potential is going to be critical.
Jeff, what do you make of the fact that, like, you just were talking about Jordan Walker, maybe recalibrating where his ceiling is? You just mentioned potentially trading Nolan Gorman. You asked about, you know, Heim Bloom, and will there be less nostalgia with him in charge? I'm not so sure there will be. I don't think there will be. But one thing I do wonder is if there'll be less of the recent past, the recent Cardinals under Heim Bloom. And the way you describe those, I mean, I don't think anybody would be shocked if there were trades and all of a sudden, who are the first round picks that are around? Michael McGreevy, J.J. Weatherholt. Zach Thompson's coming back from injury. He's not guaranteed to have a spot on the roster. I don't know. I like, what do you make of that? Like, as we watch this offseason unfold, one thing to like look at is how many of these first rounders are still around.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. Like, I thought all along this could be an optimal time for this team to make a move because they had an entire lineup full of guys that were homegrown, team controlled. Gave you a tremendous advantage having all these guys in place. And I'd say about half of them look like they're keepers, right? But not necessarily first-round picks. You know, I think Alec Burleson would be dumb to trade him. Victor Scott, second, yeah, you can't really trade him. Too much upside. But, yeah, Walker, Gorman, you know, they've still got so much to prove. Where are you with Lars Nootbaar? He's still – can he get back to 780 OPS and stay on the field? There's so many of these guys, and kind of looking at the issue on Tip Sheet, where you look at the whole issue of how many of these guys will Bloom do what his old team did, Boston, and start locking in some guys early that they like. Well, how many of these guys are actually be in that category? I think Mason Wynn is a guy you have to keep. I think Burleson you should keep. Victor Scott II you should keep. Herrera you should keep. After that, you know, to your point, and you go back to the recent Cardinal history of a lot of guys that. They did well enough, but never really became a cornerstone. Colton Long was pretty good, good fielder, pretty good player, but hit his ceiling, kind of aged out, moved on. Alan Craig got wiped out, hit well, then had the injury, didn't hit well. Carpenter had his run. DeYoung had his run. I mean, just go down the list of guys that, you know, could have been, and they end up all contributing, but then didn't really become that guy. And obviously, you're not talking about trying to become an Albert Pujols, but you would like to see some of these guys pan out and have, you know, at least long careers.
Yeah.
And get into their free agency years and get rewarded, you know, like Carpenter did, but only hold up better. I don't know. I mean, how many of these guys that we've talked about, all these exciting young guys, actually are going to be more than just replacement level guys? Who, if you could do that at a low salary, that's useful, but doesn't really get you to the playoffs.
Yeah, the Red Sox just signed Ramon Anthony to a big deal. Anthony was one of the prize draft picks during Bloom's era there in Boston. It's not really something that will be answered in this homestand, but at least we'll see more development of it in this homestand. And that's the third and final thing that I'm looking for. Maybe, again, not just in this homestand, but over the unfurling of the next few months and the beginning of the Bloom administration, is who is the player who gets a long-term extension discussion? I think the bandwidth for that answer, Jeff, could be anywhere from 0 to 4. I would be, and this seems weird to say, I would not be surprised if the answer is 0, that the Cardinals don't do an extension like we've watched Atlanta do for so often, or we've seen other teams try to do what was a pillar of spring training every year for the Cardinals, was that young guy approaching or into arbitration who would get a multi-year extension. I think it's unlikely that the answer is 0, but I can't say that any of us should be shocked if it's 0. Mason Wynn has been probably most open about his hopes and desires to be a face of the franchise, to be kind of a long-term Cardinal. Brendan Donovan has spoke candidly about having his wish for a multi-year deal, similar to, say, how Ryan Helsley did. There was discussion with Donovan this past winter. There was mutual interest this past winter in an extension with him, and then it just kind of all faded. There wasn't common ground eventually, and, you know, the Cardinals and Donovan's new agent agreed to just have arbitration settle it, and kind of table any conversation about an extension. Now what does that look like? You know, there's not been a player who has taken the Cardinals to arbitration who has then stayed with the Cardinals. Does that change with Bloom? I don't know. I mean, look, if you're to go, Jeff, if you're to go right now and go to any of these players and say, all right, let's talk about a multi-year deal. Who is it? Like, give me your order of priority. Who would you put atop there? And who would you at least put as, like, I think we could get something done?
Right. Well, in terms of my order, I would build around Wynn because he's just a ball player.
Yeah.
And he goes about the game the right way. I'd build around Burleson because he can hit. And he's a ball player, and the effort he's put in to become a better outfielder and a better first baseman. It's impressive. You need him in your mix.
Craig extension for Burleson makes sense.
Yeah, and then as far as, you know, Donovan's going to cost you some money, but at some point you have to keep good ball players, because I do not want to hear that, you know, you've talked about this. I don't want to hear this chit chat about, well, we'll just blow up this group of homegrown guys and start over again, and maybe 4 years will be good. You know, the Milwaukee Brewers are good every year, and they retool. They're always retooling. Like Pat Murphy said, we're always on trade deadline because of the situation. You know, it's just the way
great
it is.
Line.
But it's just they have to rotate, but they are going to try to maintain their guys until they can't afford them. I don't want to hear any chit chat from this front office about how this is going to take forever. When you got all these guys who are cost controlled, replacement level or better, that can give you a starting point to have a roster where other teams don't, in a division where, you know, you've got opportunity. So I think at some point you have to keep some of your guys. Now, does that go to 4 guys? You throw Weatherholt in, and there's your 4 position players that you build around, and everything else is up for grabs. I would throw Scott in and maybe make it 5, but Yeah, I know. I mean, it's a great question. And you could say zero because of Weatherholtz or shortstop. Then, you know, Mason Wynn's got value. But again, if you're trading guys like Mason Wynn, then and you're going to tell your fan base, come back in 2029, good luck. I'd hate to be one of your business partners on one of the adjacent, commercial adventures near the ballpark when you tell your fans, don't bother coming back to beat it. You think it's bad now. You start trading guys like that. I mean, people would understand Gorman. People would understand Walker. You start trading guys like, Wynn, Herrera, Burleson, or even Donovan, give up on a guy just because he's going to start costing you money. It's hard to make that sale. And the fact that you could trade somebody to get some pitching, sure. But if Heim Bloom wants to start this over again, that could be rough. That could be rough.
Where's the power in that group?
It's great. It's a great question. And where is it coming? You got Baez at AA. He's certainly a monster, but he's got to learn how to hit higher level pitching. But he's got speed and power. He's launching a few homers, got a great OPS, pretty selective at the plate, runs like the wind, gigantic. Yeah. But, it's a long way from Springfield to the big leagues, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you got like a guy like who just drafted Gurevich, right? Is he going to leapfrog into this power conversation? That's the question. You commit to contracts to the guys that you mentioned, you're locking them in. And who of that group is a middle order hitter? Alec Burleson, right? Maybe.
Yeah.
JJ Weatherholt could be a number two hitter, right? He's got high ability, lots to like about him as a player, but he's a more well-rounded as opposed to a feared hitter. The bulk power guy, where is he? This came up in Los Angeles as Oliver Marmol was talking about kind of like the pesky offense, like that they are at their best, right? Kind of whatever, Brent Brown calls hit collectors and putting things together. He said that's got to be the – I mean, like, I was really struck by how they just wore pitchers out on that game Wednesday. Otani was brilliant. He was exceptional. He was throwing 100 miles an hour and hitting the black, but they knew that he had a low pitch count. And so they kind of went into this thinking, all right, well, how do you kind of grind up pitchers? And that benefited them as that game unfolded. And, you saw a 10-pitch at bat by Mason Wynn that ended with a changeup that he wrote for a single. You saw an 8-pitch at bat by pinch hitter Yoel Pozo, who then it flew out, but still 18 pitches to two guys. And then the next guy up was Jordan Walker, who delivered the key hit of the innings. So, and Marmol talked about that's got to become the identity of the team. And then he made the point, not just now, but going forward. And I think that's such a telling description of what they expect to have, and also, Jeff, what they expect to spend, because power costs money.
Yeah, and I think because you mentioned a number of guys who aren't your classic power hitters that I think would be worth building around doesn't preclude you from continuing to seek guys who do have power. Don't throw away guys who are good ball players unless you're going to somehow construct a trade where you're going to get, a guy that's going to give you that clout. So, and I look at the lineup too, going forward, you're going to want a better hitter behind the plate than Pedro. Pedro was a competitive hitter last year in game situations, less so this year. You're going to have to do better. Watch Jimmy Crooks get a couple opposite field hits on the Memphis game yesterday. Not sure he's the guy. He's got a ways to go. I don't know how he would translate as a hitter to the big leagues. Herrera, you're going to have to probably leave in the field somewhere else. So that's a spot. Scott obviously has to become have a better on-base percentage if he's going to do what he does and stay as a regular to use his speed and also to be a fielder. He's going to have to hit better. He's got to continue to evolve. He can't hit a ceiling. So, yeah, there's a lot. But there's also a lot to talk about the bottom of the order besides the power in the middle too, right?
Right.
So, and if the power was supposed to come from Walker and Gorman, and now we still have the big giant question mark over their heads coming into this series and the rest of the season. Yeah, it's challenging. But again, you're dealing with a situation. You've got a lot of guys who can play baseball here for a long time. I do not want to hear that this is going to take forever because there are teams who, against all odds, Derek, do enough in one off season to be competitive the next year.
It is incredible that they do that. They do that. And then there are teams that don't do anything near enough and are sellers at the deadline, despite a really good, talented young core that is more advanced than the Cardinals' young core, and that's the Baltimore Orioles. So lessons abound. Lessons abound in how to do. All right, what's the last thing you're looking for during this homestand?
Yeah, you know, you would talk about the starting pitching, and it's such a interesting experience to watch. You know, Michael McGreevy is going to give up runs. You know, he's a number five type pitcher. He's going to give up runs. You loved his mental response, in-game response to get through innings or to protect his bullpen or get through innings to get to a point where he can win the game, to shake off what happens, to keep pitching, to have resolve, to adapt in game, and to stick with it. And unfortunately, there's going to be a lot of that with these guys. You know, Matthew Liberatore continuing to go through that, learning about what a 28-start season looks like, you know, mm-hmm. 29-start, what is that going to look like in his future? Same with Andre Pallante, who's telling us that he's fine, but he's evolving, he's learning, still trying to figure out that knuckle curve thing to get it in the strike zone more often. So I'm just watching those guys and knowing that they're going to take some beatings in here at points, but just watching how do they respond mentally, how do they adapt, and really how does the team handle them? Because at some point you risk causing damage psychologically or physically given the lack of a safety net, although the fact Quinn Matthews found the strike zone his last two starts indicates that maybe at the end of the season they get a few starts out of him and let some guys catch their breath.
What a timing for his best start, right? The primetime show, no Weatherholt in the lineup, Cardinals promoting their look at Memphis on their broadcast partner, and Quinn Matthews comes through. Very impressive. All right, let's close here. Jeff, we didn't have a chance to talk following the trade deadline. What was your takeaway from the Cardinals' actions as sellers for the second time in three seasons, and only really the second time in a long span of this current century, to be honest, that they were sellers?
Well, two things I needed. They addressed both. We'll see how well that group does, but they needed more pitching of all descriptions. And they needed right-handed hitters, right? Mm-hmm. And the two guys they got who are right-handed hitters have at least some power profile, one much closer to the majors than the other, but certainly two corner infielders who could at least enter the conversation at some point about adding more clout to the group if they progress. So, I mean, you addressed your needs. I think independent evaluators were generally positive about the returns. You know, we talked before on video about how the return being more long-range – The year term was indicative of just how much work there is to do for the organization. But at least I thought they addressed needs. They did what they had to do. It's unpleasant losing those people. But, you know, the season is going where it is. And you need to give Heim the best opportunity going forward. And good to see that he obviously had input in terms of the return from Boston. So good to see that he was in the middle of that conversation. And kind of looking forward to see what happens next with the organization.
Yeah, I think that was the big thing that struck me was the conversation about how it was the long-range future, you know, not immediate future. This is down the road future. Blaze Jordan, the power hitter the power profile hitter. He hasn't hit for much power, but he's really been a smart and productive hitter, 300 hitter, good on base percentage, doesn't strike out much, but that power profile he had that got all the attention when he was in high school and hitting absolute tanks, as they say, in home run derbies, that hasn't really manifested in his pro career. Maybe it does. He's at AAA already. He'll be playing closest to his home possible. He's from Northern Mississippi. So that's a cool fit and a good get from the right side. We'll see where he fits into all of this, but he's about as close as any of these guys get. And I thought just the contrast of what the Giants got for Rodgers and what the Cardinals got for Helsley from the same team, the Mets, was really telling. You know, three players coming the out of the Mets in both trades. One of those deals nets three guys who you know are going to contribute in the majors. They're on the doorstep. One of them is already in the majors. They're going to get – now are they going to be stars? Are they going to be impact? Who knows? But they're going to contribute. With the Cardinals – the three players were coming from Class A, and you don't know. They may never reach the majors. Likelihood that one certainly has the profile of a pitcher who will, starter now, could be in a reliever, has that power, has a has kind of the mix of pitches that the Cardinals are prioritizing, the pitch characteristics or pitch traits that the Cardinals are really looking for. But I don't, you know, but you don't have a guarantee that any of them are going to reach the majors. And that's just a real interesting contrast that the Giants would go for three players who could contribute in the near future. And the Cardinals would be like, well, we got some time. Let's see if we can go get guys who are going to have higher ceilings when they do arrive. You know, it's an interesting position that they put themselves in because they also added some depth, which we'll see if this plays out, would allow them to outfit trades this winter for more immediate help, Gordo. Like if they wanted to say, all right, as we've discussed, trade Gorman or trade, you know, a pitcher or trade Walker, they could add some of the players that they brought in at the trade deadline as sort of the players on the upside players on the periphery to get more immediate help. So we'll see. But it sure sounded like in the comments made by Mozeliak that he was like, these are moves for the distant future when they can help a team contend. And the upshot of that for fans is like, well, wait, what? This is a 2-year thing, not a 2 months into the Heim Bloom. We're going to see some movement. We're going to see some improvement. No, this is a 2-year thing when some of these guys might arrive and contribute. Woo. What does that mean for some of the runway players here who like Lars Nootbaar, 2 years away from free agency, Brendan Donovan, 2 years away from free agency. Where do they fit in if that's what the trade deadline was about?
And how compounding or what kind of influence did the fact that they've got pitchers they were hoping to be near-term answers eradicated by injury? Mm-hmm. You've got to figure out how to manage your 40-man roster, project yourself going forward, Rule 5 draft, all this stuff. With so many guys, you know, not able to pitch for a long time that you nonetheless aren't going to want to give up on. You have to project them somewhere down the road for you, but you got to navigate your roster. It seemed like there was kind of an unpleasant scenario that developed for the front office, given the piling up of those serious injuries.
Yeah, three elbow surgeries. I mean, that's a big deal. Tekoa Roby was set to leave this season as their top pitching prospect, possibly. You didn't have to squint to see him leapfrogging Quinn Matthews in that discussion, given how he performed in spring, some of what he did during the season, got promoted to AAA, and now he's had Tommy John, and it looks like he may miss the entirety of the 2026 season when it comes to competitive games, like appearing in affiliate games, and his focus will be on 2027. So yeah, that's a hit. I mean, then a few other ones too, you know, you got Zach Thompson, Sem Roberce, Drew Rahm. These guys some of them were supposed to provide depth. Some of them were supposed to provide impact. Some of them were supposed to be the future, and all of them are really struggling to come back from injury.
Well, it's a tough scenario. So how do we sell tickets here? It's not really our job, but, you know, it's been kind of sad going to the ballpark and seeing all those empty seats. What can we do I wouldn't say let's throw a balloon party over what's happening around here, like our old friend Joe Strauss would say, but can we at least pump a little bit of sunshine here, Derek, before we leave?
Well, San Diego was quite a party. I mean, San Diego was like, it was very impressive. The atmosphere, the vibe. What they have going in San Diego is super impressive. I mean, they also have like a push button bullpen that is super impressive. I mean, when they can go to a guy who would close for many teams, including the Cardinals, and go to him in the fifth inning, that is a whole lot of options at Mike Schilt's fingertips to close out games and catch the Dodgers. And they had three sellouts for the Cardinals. Dodgers couldn't claim that. They had vibrant activity there. You know, I understand your question. I don't have a recipe for it, except for the Cardinals continue. I mean, the Cardinals could. When I was there at San Diego, and I was trying to think of how to articulate, so here goes. Remember what it was like at Busch Stadium 12, 13, 14 years ago? Do you remember that? Like, sure. Just peak Cardinals at the new downtown ballpark. Man, that is a lot of what it was like at San Diego. It was like San Diego 2025 is the modern version of the Cardinals 20 2011 or really 2013, somewhere in that era, you know, are a kind of an alloy of those teams, right? Because they got the star players. Cardinals had the star players. They had the Carlos Beltrans. They had the Matt Holliday there early on in that stretch that I was talking about. They had the homegrown guys and Albert Pujols. Of course, Yadier Molina was there the entire time. You know, they have the pitching. They have some, you know, they had really strong standout prospects who were bringing some elements of that modern electricity to it. You think of Carlos Martinez, think of Trevor Rosenthal, Jason Mott with his power, you know, the velocity coming out in the ninth inning there. So what the Cardinals were at that time and the kind of like happening, like the event draw, the good times, good baseball, good atmosphere that Busch Stadium had at that time, man, the modern equivalent of that is right now in San Diego. And how do the Cardinals get that back? I mean, it wouldn't hurt to visit San Diego and look at what they're doing. You're not going to obviously have San Diego temperatures and San Diego beach and San Diego water and all that stuff. Fine. But you can have some of the San Diego feel, or at least take a Midwestern turn on it when it comes to the ballpark and what they're doing to bring people in, make it a party, make it fun. They have a sing-along song. I can't say it enough. The best ballparks right now have something that fans want to join in. That could be somebody. The fact that no Cardinal has a walk-up music that fans want to sing along as he walks to the plate just boggles my mind. How do they not have that? It's such a cool event that Phillies have. And, you know, the Padres have a song that they play and everybody sings along and they get a little grin as they deliver one of the lines together and make it sarcastic. It's really good. And so the ingredients are right there. The recipe is right there for the Cardinals to see. All it takes is stars, getting stars, playing winning baseball. That helps. And then investing in and improving the atmosphere at the ballpark so that it's not just about the ball game. It's also about the thrill of being in the community and being part of the spectacle. That's it. That's it right there. The fans being part of the spectacle and sharing in it in that way. And, you know, the Cardinals have to kind of reinvigorate that. And whether that's sparking the best fans in baseball again. But it has to be more than that. It has to do more than just respect the game and the applause for the opponent who does well. They got to animate that, and they haven't. And until they do, I don't know. That, I mean, that's got to be part of the comeback. Star players and animating the audience.
I don't think hitting the button so that you hear everybody clap your hands a few more times is going to make a difference.
No, that's not the sing-along song that I'm talking about. No, that is not. No.
And also,
and I know the Cardinals are doing it. You know, they have folks going to other ballparks to see. They've made some changes. It is on their minds. So, you know, this isn't me. I mean, a few years ago, I felt like when I brought this up, I was shouting into the wind of the fact that, you know, the Cardinals weren't listening or weren't changing. That's not the case now. They have new people in place. They are very much aware of it. They want to have more of a modern kind of feel at the game. Again, they have to have stars. They have to have star players that people want to see. But they also have to make it a really entertaining event at the ballpark. And one way to do that is to borrow from live concerts, borrow from what they do at Fenway, borrow from Go Cubs Go, for goodness sake. You know, go get yourself a theme song for crying out loud. You know, do that stuff that borrows from both the 80s and, you know, other ballparks to make things kind of thrive again, to make that place pulse, to make it, you know, the epicenter of downtown that radiates and you feel when there's a ball game going on. You asked, is there going to be more nostalgia or less nostalgia for Chaim Bloom and when he takes over on baseball operations? I would I'm gonna flip it a little bit and say maybe there needs to be less nostalgia for the ballpark operations.
Well, listen, I hope fans don't do this, but there is a potential drinking game for those watching. Every ball game is how many times you hear a siren watching the game?
Yeah,
a lot, a lot. In the background, it's just sort of ever present. If you're attending the game, how many times you hear it?
I mean, that's part of the proximity to the highway, though.
Yeah, it's just part of the deal, right? I mean, it's just kind of sad.
You're going to hear motorcycles and everything. Yeah, yeah. We've solved nothing, Jeff. We've solved nothing.
Put an ocean where the river is. That would fix it.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, surf the Mississippi.
There you go. All right, man. Well, we tried, Derek. I tried to get you to pump some sunshine. At least you've given him a roadmap here.
Yeah. San Diego was a blast, man. The thing, what they got going there is a good thing. And, you know, now having seen it fade in St. Louis, man, cherish it. Cherish it, Padre fans. Holy cow. Because, yeah, I mean, it can go away. And it's like, what was it? Is how Hemingway wrote, and it so applies to the Cardinals, right? Like, how'd you go broke? Slowly then suddenly, right? How'd it happen for the Cardinals? Slowly then suddenly. I mean, it's Hemingway. That's what happened to the Cardinals. It's slowly then suddenly.
That's a depressing note to end on, Derek.
Quoting Hemingway?
No, that particular quote.
Sorry. Sorry, folks. Enjoy the homestand. That's Jeff Gordon, sports columnist at the St. Louis Post Dispatch and STLToday.com. He's got a chat to run to. So, you know, by the time this thing posts, he'll have already fielded and answered all of your questions, and you'll have none left because he will have given it all. He'll have answered all the things that we presented. He just needs the time to do it. You can find his work at STLToday.com, and in the pages of the Post Dispatch, you can find all of our constant Cardinals coverage at STLToday.com and at the Post Dispatch. You can find chats galore, the video that you do with Lynn Worthy, Inside Pitch, the newsletter that I write, The Right Fielder, that comes out every Friday, and of course all the coverage from baseball writer Daniel Guerrero there, especially during this homestand as the Cubs visit for three with Yadier Molina making a two-game appearance in the Cardinals dugout. Then the Colorado Rockies come to town, and finally the Pinstripes and Paul Goldschmidt. Though I guess they're not really the Pinstripes when they're on the road. They're more the road grays. The Yankees are in town with first baseman Paul Goldschmidt. His return to St. Louis since signing a free agent. We didn't even touch on that. But we have next week, because the best podcast in baseball is brought to you weekly by Closet by Design of St. Louis. For the best podcast in baseball and sports columnist, Jeff Gordon, I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. Talk to you soon. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
See you at the ballpark.